Welcome, everybody, to this edition of the World Soccer Talk podcast. I'm your host, Richard Farley. Thank you very much for joining us. When we last had the Premier League in our lives, Manchester City were on top of the table, Arsenal and United were close behind, and a pair of clubs were looking for new managers. Now, after the ninth match day of the season, City is still on top, Arsenal and Manchester United are still on their heels, but two new bosses have made their debuts. We'll get to Sam Allardyce's first match with Sunderland later in the show, but now, as I bring in my co-hosts Lawrence McKenna and Kartik Krishnayar, we're going to focus on the Premier League's new boyfriend, Jurgen Klopp. Liverpool hired the former Borussia Dortmund and Mainz boss over the break and saw him debut to a 0-0 draw at White Hart Lane. And Lawrence, although the result wasn't ideal, Klopp's fingerprints were all over his new team from the opening kickoff.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, that was part of the interesting thing, was that people were wondering how much work could he do in just a few days. And the fact was that people have been speaking all week about gegenpressing, or gegenpressing, and the impressive style with which Liverpool would play from that. And I think that excited a lot of people because people felt quite tired of what was going on with Brendan Rodgers. But I think essentially what I was interested in was Klopp was able to put his fingerprints all over this team because of the squad that's been assembled at Liverpool and the adaptability that they've very often shown under Brendan Rodgers if they showed a lack of application. And he played a 4-3-2-1 at the weekend. And, you know, a lot of people were very quick to point out that's a very unusual formation. But what I will point out is that number of young players in this side who have developed under Brendan Rodgers, there are a number of very intelligent players who, you know, were brought in by Brendan Rodgers and the transfer committee. A lot of players who'd learned to become more adaptable, three at the back, you know, playing with a number of different ways in front of them. And I think that that is partly also down to Brendan Rodgers. So it's not, you know, it's not all, and, you know, I mean, Sam Allardyce will be the first one to tell you, this was essentially Brendan Rodgers coming out with this win, because Rafa Benitez didn't win the Champions League.
Yeah, a lot of defenders of Brendan Rodgers coming from the same corners that Brendan Rodgers probably is in right now. Kartik, but you and I probably were, I guess, justifiably excited, just like everybody else. We're starting to get to the point where we were making fun of the excitement around Jurgen Klopp, but this was a really significant addition for the Premier League. And over those first 20 or 25 minutes at White Hart Lane before Liverpool's players started to wilt a little bit, I did still feel that excitement.
Yeah, I felt the excitement. I mean, part of it, I think, is because the Premier League itself doesn't have many genuine stars, playing stars. Maybe one genuine world-class player in the league, in my opinion, and now Alexis Sanchez. Maybe a second in David Silva, but it's not the top stars. I always forget goalkeepers. Yes. De Gea is world-class, no question. But I think the Premier League has less legitimate stars than the Bundesliga, the La Liga, or Liga 1. And Liga 1, they're all on one team. But so we're looking for coaches to provide that excitement in the history of clubs and the pageantry around clubs. And it does it, quite frankly, because the league is still more exciting than those leagues I mentioned. Even though those leagues have all the world-class stars. But Klopp is a genuine character. He's a genuine superstar of world football, not only for the way his teams entertain, but because of his own demeanor. And we're real excited to have him in England. And I felt that excitement. I mean, I passed on watching Frank Lampard, David Villa, Kaká, and Andrea Pirlo in person in order really just to watch Jurgen Klopp on television. That tells you how excited personally I was for this game.
Yeah, England has always, as a culture, always been really close to, really quick to adopt kind of the cult of the manager. I think managers in England are revered more than, not in, just in any other league, any other sport. I think that was one of the things when I really started following the Premier League that was just so mind-boggling to me, how much everybody leans on every single word the manager says. But Lawrence, this was beyond words. I think you saw a lot of stats from Sky note that this was the first time that Tottenham had been outrun at all this year. James Milner covered 13 kilometers, the person who was really responsible for the flexibility of that formation we saw on Saturday. And as a result, even though Jurgen Klopp didn't get 3 points, this still felt like Liverpool had made some clear, at least to the eye, improvements over the short time Klopp has been at the club.
Yeah, very good point. Although, I mean, Kristen Henninger, who used to be on this podcast, made the joke to me that it was probably just Mignolet in shuttle runs in the penalty box that meant that this team had run 10K further. What I would say is, though, with Klopp, I mean, like you say, we're very quick to buy into the mysticism. That somewhat takes away from some of the analysis. And it's Jurgen Klopp is not... he's not who's the guy who coached the Bulls when Jordan was there?
Phil Jackson.
He's not Phil Jackson, but sometimes I feel like Phil Jackson gets a very light analysis when coming to a new team because he's Phil Jackson. Do you know what I mean? And I feel a little bit like it's similar with Jurgen Klopp here, because it's like, he's just a taller Jurgen Klopp, essentially, isn't he? And that's what I'm saying, is that everything is now mysticized about Klopp. So it's, you know, Klopp didn't just go out to look at the match. He didn't just go out to look at the pitch pregame. He went out to survey the turf. He didn't just talk to the players. He gave the ultimate pep talk to Divock Origi. You know, he wasn't just at the sideline. You know, if Brendan Rodgers shouted something on the sideline, that was just Brendan Rodgers shouting something. This was Jurgen Klopp shouting something here, guys. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's what annoys me a little bit, is that this week I had callers on another show where we do a live call-in, and they were calling in and just going, I just want to talk about Klopp. And I was like, yeah, but what about the way that Lallana pushed here? And they were like, yeah, I don't know what you mean.
I think he did a really good job of highlighting where the excitement for Klopp stops and kind of the forced narrative begins when you do get a man just walking out on the pitch before the game and he's serving instead of just going through his normal preparations. But Kartik, I think Lawrence did a good job of transitioning us into actually talking about the game, but we can still keep it Klopp-centric. He is the story of the week. His debut is the story of the week. And for me, and I think for a lot of people, it was about how individual players were going to fit into what Klopp does. And I think we got a good idea, at least a good idea for as much of an idea we can get over 90 minutes. I was focused on both the players that I thought would adapt well, Emre Can, Daniel Klein, Daniel Sturridge, who didn't play it, and I really thought Adam Lallana would adapt well to the system, even though I didn't imagine he would be playing in a two behind a one, which we can talk about that. And then James Milner played better than I thought he would. We haven't seen Jordan Henderson yet, or Christian Benteke, two other people that I thought maybe would, maybe not struggle in the case of Henderson, but his skills aren't a perfect fit. And Martin Skrtel is the other player that I'm worried about. What about you in general from what we saw against Spurs? Which players do you think look like they're good fits? Which players maybe do you have concerns with?
Well, we didn't see Benteke. I don't think he's going to fit this style or system at all. I think he's probably going to have a short Anfield career based on his skill set. But so we didn't see him. I thought Origi was very good, but we knew Origi was a player, other than his finishing, was very good. We know Origi's a player that Klopp liked, because that's the one guy on this Liverpool side we know he tried to sign to Dortmund. So that is one player he was familiar with and he would like and can play the way he wants to play. I think Milner was very good in this game. That we kind of expected. Maybe not quick enough in some people's minds for a Klopp system, but he will do the running. Mm-hmm. I can attest to that as someone who watched him for five seasons with Manchester City. I thought Emre Can looked comfortable, partly because he was just back in his natural role, and he's been shuttled all over the pitch by Brendan Rodgers and by Yogi Löw the last couple months for both club and country. A player I was not pleased with was Philippe Coutinho. He didn't look comfortable in that role, that dual whole role or whatever you want to call it behind Origi, pairing with Lallana. I didn't see the kind of energy I expected from him. I thought some of his touches were kind of questionable. I think he may have been confused by the setup. We'll have to continue to watch him as we go forward.
Yeah, I think I'm holding back on Coutinho because for the last couple weeks I've had so many Liverpool fans come to me and be like, oh, you clearly don't know Felipe Coutinho. He's one of the hardest workers in the team and he'll adapt immediately. And you're saying he's not as good as Shinji Kagawa, which I never said. I just said he's a different player than Shinji Kagawa was at Dortmund.
And don't say it, Richard. Don't be a dick. Come on.
Well,
all I'm saying is with Coutinho, we saw a different skill set from Coutinho that maybe Liverpool have fallen in love with Coutinho, which is the,
right,
you know, he's a little magician, you know, and for that reason, you know, magicians aren't very physical people always. but the point would be that he actually put his body between a couple of people and surprised, I think, Liverpool fans.
Yeah, no,
I think that's maybe the problem, is that actually what people are thinking is that Klopp isn't he's literally got this system and he goes, right, who's going to fit into it?
Yeah.
And who doesn't? And I think actually the point would be here, there's going to be a number of, you know, this is somewhat of a halfway house of a game, which is why I'd imagine Spurs were disappointed, because, you know, Liverpool were essentially ripe for the taking, having just a few days of tactics from a very good coach. But still, the point would be there that Klopp is a good enough coach to recognize what he can play. No, and that's why they're playing.
I agree with you. That's why I'm holding back on Coutinho. I don't think he's a great fit or a poor fit. I think he's somebody that Klopp can help mold. And I think it is kind of
adding to your point. I don't think I'm arguing against.
I think it is kind of a wake up call because, as you alluded, Liverpool fans have come to cherish Felipe Coutinho because he's been a very good player for them. But it is kind of a reminder that the talent level at Liverpool is at a certain place right now, and there aren't any true world-class players in that team. And as a result, you're not going to have people that are just going to naturally, like a fish to water, become spectacular. It's going to take a little bit of time, and maybe Coutinho will be a spectacular player after a little bit of time. I think that it's only 90 minutes so far.
I do think that's a bit of a worry for Liverpool, is that actually Liverpool have become a club who have gotten very used to a certain kind of mentality, and it's not actually a very successful mentality in that sense. And I think, especially in the 90s, it was Neil Atkinson from the Anfield Wrap who summed it up perfectly for me when I made a Liverpool documentary. He said, Liverpool were conservative with a small C, and that applied to their business and sometimes what happened on the pitch. And it meant that very often they put all of their hope on young people who were good instead of everything else, because they didn't know what else they could there was nothing for them to grasp onto. And it seems as if Klopp has given them something else that they can maybe, like a vine they can grasp onto now, which can take them away from that.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult to let go of the previous one.
Yeah, but as you allude, it could be a positive. I want to, before we go into our read of the results, I want to talk to you a little bit, Lawrence, because before Saturday's match, and a couple of times, even in speculating when Jurgen Klopp might come in, you had noted that Liverpool is not that far back of fourth place. And bringing somebody like Klopp in might be just what you need to take a pretty deep and reasonably talented squad and compete for that last Champions League spot. Has your view at all changed? Change is probably the wrong word. It is only 90 minutes. But how has your view been informed after that 90 minutes?
Good question. In terms of Klopp, it's probably stayed the same. In terms of the Liverpool team, I was very buoyed by the way that they reacted to what Klopp's done over the past week. Mm-hmm. I think you're right in the new boyfriend thing, that there should always be skeptical questions asked. And I think my view as a football fan recently has been that a lot of people in Britain look to set football fans up directly against each other. TalkSport goes, a United fan said this. Which Liverpool fan's going to call in and tell him he's a dick? Or, you know, and I think actually what I've realized more recently is a lot of football fans need to be standing shoulder to shoulder and sort of going, hold on, what's going on at your club here? Like, Liverpool fans need to be standing with Manchester United fans, and Liverpool fans shouldn't be defensive if someone's saying that's not good enough or this isn't very good. And so I think what needs to happen at Liverpool is that they need to look at themselves in context of the Premier League and look, they probably are maybe the fifth best team this season. Maybe the sixth best team behind Spurs, but Spurs then proven maybe they were not. So I think there's a lot of confidence, but within context of the league, look at the other results this weekend, and maybe you're seeing how far Liverpool are behind those guys.
Well, Klopp will take charge of his second game with Liverpool on Thursday when Russia's Rubin Kazan arrive at Anfield in Europa League. And just a small reminder, Klopp's previous team, Borussia Dortmund, is in that competition, perhaps something to look forward to down the road. But on England's shores, there were eight other matches this weekend. On Saturday at Stamford Bridge, Diego Costa scored once and caused a second-half own goal. After a number of lineup changes, Jose Mourinho got Chelsea back into the win column with a 2-0 victory over visiting Aston Villa. At Selhurst Park, the first-half dismissal of Dwight Gayle came good for West Ham late in the second half when goals by Manuel Lanzini and Dimitri Payet broke a 1-1 tie, giving the Hammers a 3-1 derby win over Crystal Palace. Manchester United gave one of their most impressive performances of the season, scoring three goals in the first 62 minutes at Goodison Park to take a 3-0 win over Everton. League-leading Manchester City were without Sergio Aguero, David Silva, and Vincent Kompany, and still cruised to a 5-1 win over Bournemouth. Raheem Sterling had a first-half hat-trick at the Etihad. Southampton got goals from Jose Fonte and Virgil van Dijk to take a 2-0 lead into halftime at St. Mary's, but a second-half brace from Jamie Vardy, the second goal coming at stoppage time, gave Leicester another comeback result, a 2-2 draw. Sam Allardyce's debut was the least watchable match of the weekend, with West Brom breaking through against the run of play in the second half to post a 1-0 win over Sunderland at the Hawthorns, and Arsenal outlasted a dogged hour from Watford, broke through with three goals in 12 minutes at Vicarage Road, posting a 3-0 win on the road. On Sunday, 6 shots on target, 6 goals for Newcastle, who got their first win of the season thanks to 4 goals for Jorginho Wijnaldum. 6-2 was the final against Norwich at St. James's Park. As for the table, Manchester City has a 2-point lead over Arsenal and Manchester United. West Ham's win keeps them fourth, with Leicester and Crystal Palace close behind. Perhaps the more telling news is at the bottom of the table, though, where Newcastle climbed from 20th to 18th, now only 2 points from safety. Aston Villa is next with only 4 points from 9 games, while Sunderland is the last winless team of the Premier League and at the bottom of the table. When we come back, we'll focus on the games at the Etihad, Vicarage Road, and Goodison Park. But right now, let's talk about our sponsor. You know, Rabble.tv has been our sponsor since I returned to the show. And Rabble.tv is actually a big part of this show's life. We have one person here who just this past week did 2 things with Rabble.tv associated with World Soccer Talk. I think he did a couple of other things associated with his own site. Kartik, you called the U.S. Costa Rica game on Tuesday. You also did your Divers and Cheats show on Thursday. You tend to have a pretty busy weekly life with Rabble.tv.
Yeah, I have something going on with Rabble, it seems, every day. I've got it obviously... This week was interesting because we had the international break and this game, this U.S. Costa Rica game, which I called with Matt Lichtenstein, former member of our podcast team, and of Divers and Cheats, where we discussed the MLS's role in the U.S. national team setup. Has the MLS become a detriment to the United States national team, both in the sense that are players not getting the right tactical training, and are they not fit enough to play for the U.S. national team? And the flip side, has MLS become such a strong and competitive league that it's helping the neighboring CONCACAF countries who have their players in MLS, and they're getting better, and they're competing hard with the United States, and they're beating the United States often because they have players playing at a high level in Major League Soccer. So discuss that. As you said, I have my own stuff going on related to the second division in our country, North American Soccer League, where I cover the Fort Lauderdale Strikers and Tampa Bay Rowdies on Rabble regularly. But it's a great platform. And anytime you want to call a game, if you don't like what Ray Hudson's doing as we speak, as we're recording on the Inter Juve Derby, you could start a Rabble broadcast and do your own job. I know a lot of people don't like Ray Hudson. And in many cases, in these sorts of games, I would like to listen to someone on Rabble who knows the two clubs very well. So it'd be great.
Well, Kartik, you're obviously making good use of Rabble.tv. If you follow Kartik on Twitter, you know exactly when he's going to have an alternative broadcast or his actual show for you. But he's not the only one that's making use of the product. We have a number of people within the World Soccer Top family that use Rabble.tv on a regular basis, which is why we're recommending the service to you. Now, what is it exactly? Rabble.tv is a place to listen to live match commentaries from real fans while games are being played, and the way it works is really simple. All you have to do is tune into your game, but then press the mute button on your television or in your browser, then head over to Rabble.tv to listen to soccer fans providing their own call. Or, better yet, you can create your own broadcast, call one of your team's games just by signing up for free and switching on your computer's microphone. You can listen to a broadcast on your desktop, through your iOS app, and now through your mobile browser. Sign up today at Rabble.tv, where it's your team and it's your call. Gentlemen, Liverpool was the big story of the weekend, but with everybody back in action, of course, there is going to be some focus at the top of the table, where even though Manchester City has been the focus team this year, it was relatively tight coming into the weekend. City, Arsenal, Manchester United, all within 2 points of each other. Let's talk about those 3 teams this segment. Kartik, we mentioned that City still without so many players, even though Pablo Zabaleta returned this weekend, looked kind of like his typical impactful self, but they were still without Sergio Aguero, who's going to be without him for some time. David Silva, who's on the verge of coming back. Vincent Kompany actually probably will play in Champions League. I think Manuel Pellegrini saying he mostly held him out because he hadn't had a full week of training. 5-1 victory in this one, Kartik. What stood out to you?
Well, on Kompany, real quickly, Pellegrini was very unhappy with Mark Wilmots.
Yeah, I think he should be too.
Yeah, right. So I think he almost held Kompany out to prove a point, saying you can't play a guy, start a guy in a game you don't have to win. Although I guess Belgium was playing to win because they wanted this farcical FIFA number one ranking. That not that I'm saying Belgium is farcical, but the FIFA rankings are farcical. So that's why they played him. And obviously, he came back without a full week of training and isn't fully fit, so he didn't play. But I think Zabaleta's return was very, very important down that right side, and he combined well with City's attacking players. Sanya shifted to the left, where Kolarov got injured in national team duty for Serbia, and Gael Clichy is still not fully fit. So Sanya showed he could play on the left side also, which gives City some more options, because the plan coming into the season for Pellegrini was to use Fabian and Delph at times at left back. And the times when Delph could have been helpful at left back have already presented themselves, but he's been injured. So Sanya being tried there worked, at least in this game. So that was important. And then obviously, I think the most critical thing was that Wilfred Bone got going with a couple goals, and he looked good, and his movement was good, and he contributed to Sterling's performance, which to me wasn't a surprise. Sterling has done everything well this season other than finish, and we knew he would start finishing at some point, and he did in this game.
Yeah, Boney had 2 goals, Sterling had 3. Some other really good performances. You talked about Pablo Zabaleta. Jesus Navas had an embarrassing moment before halftime, which eventually turned into Raheem Sterling goal, but he and Zabaleta did some good things down the right side. Kevin De Bruyne had a really nice strike.
Can I just jump in for a minute? Yeah. This is a shout-out to all the City fans who are listening, okay? You guys have some strange expectation for Jesus Navas, and I see so much criticism of him on Twitter, and I never see any praise for the things he does. And he is an important player in this side, and if Manchester City are going to win the title, I'm sorry, this is kind of a moment of personal privilege, you guys are going to have to back off the guy and just appreciate what he does and what he brings, and how when things aren't going well often in matches, he's the guy that can run at defenders, draw corners, draw set-piece opportunities, and he has an important role to play. So just because he's a terrible finisher doesn't mean he doesn't belong in this side. Sorry.
It's okay.
I just felt like I had to say that.
Lawrence, let's bring you in. Let's get some perspective from you on this, because the one thing that
I hate who's Jesus Navas, I'll say that, guys.
Well, yeah, I don't think it's really safe to have that opinion right now. The one thing that really dawned on me when I was watching this game is that in the Premier League this year, maybe it's because of the parity of the league, we really don't see very many dominant performances from teams. Even when Arsenal went to Leicester a couple weeks ago, 1-5-2, it was more of a surge that came throughout the game. It wasn't kind of an end-to-end dominance. And in this one, even though Bournemouth started brightly and had some moments where City's defense looked a Mangala influence, let's just call it that, this was a rare dominant, this is a team that looks like a champion performance, at least in my eyes.
Yeah, but I guess City are the only team that have really put in that performance so far this season.
I can't think of another one. I bring this up because we're going to talk about this a little bit with Manchester United later, who had a very bright start at Goodison. But even in that one, Manchester United came out of halftime, couldn't maintain the momentum. City, we've seen this 4 or 5 times this year, and pretty much when their squad is healthy, and they didn't have a very healthy squad this weekend, they have been the only team that's really looked like a champion so far to me.
I'd love to put that down to the tactical diversity of the league. But maybe I might put it down to the tactical... It's not ineptitude, the tactical experimentation that a lot of managers possibly go through, because I think a lot of people don't quite know how to match their teams up against all these different sides. A few years ago, you could pretty much have gone, are they going to play 4-5-1? Yeah, they're going to play 4-5-1. Will it look more like a 4-3-3 when they're attacking? At times. And that would have been the Premier League in a nutshell. And if someone played 2 up top, people would have said, what's Tony Pulis doing? And now that's not the case anymore. And I think it leads to more interesting results like this. It makes it harder to dominate the game, like you say. But I also think it can lead to some false, not conclusions, but it does lead to, can we just say it leads to tactical inconsistencies?
Yeah, or analytical inconsistencies too on our part.
Well, on both, but I think is that it's almost, I mean, if there was such a navel-gazing thing as the media, then, you know, we probably have a show where we had a podcast about the other podcast and how good the podcast had been analyzing the football of the weekend.
So you haven't seen my podcast power rankings then?
I don't follow Chard on Twitter. But my point of that would be that there is a, you know, that's the problem, is that there is a tactical diversity to the league, in inverted commas. And because of that tactical diversity, we see less domination like that. Whereas a few years ago, you would have seen, managers such as Rafa Benitez and Jose Mourinho were seen as dominant characters and dominant tactical managers. And now those things are not related in the same way, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think so either. I think there is kind of an evolution there. Much in the same way there's been an evolution about somebody like Arsene Wenger, who is no longer looked at as a tactical marvel, or at least not talked about as a tactical mind the same way he he was in his first decade in the Liga. But
people talk about dusting him off, though, and I don't know. I guess it's just maybe we talk about this
every podcast, though, is that Arsenal is so inconsistent, so up and down, that we end up recycling the narratives from 10 years ago, recycling the narratives from 4 years ago, depending on whether they've had a good day or a bad day. So I guess I'll ask you, Lawrence, whether what we saw on Saturday was a good day or a bad day. I think it's kind of in between. I think that Watford is a very good team, or at least a very difficult team to play, as they showed over the first half hour. But then over a 13-minute stretch, Arsenal scored 3 goals, looked very good. And I don't think you can call this the kind of complete performance that maybe I was trying to describe, ascribe to City. But I still think this is a very good result. Arsenal basically showed that they were able to weather a very determined team, and at the end, post a very comfortable victory.
Yeah, it looks a lot more comfortable when you look at the stats. Well, I mean, you know, obviously they had a lot more possession away from home, which is always positive for them. I think they had 64% of that possession. In terms of the other things, I think in terms of their shots, they were very equal, which I think is what you're showing. Is if we maybe looked at the highlights, it looks much closer. But I think Arsene Wenger will always talk to you about the nuances of those things and say how he felt Arsenal were always in control of the game in that sense.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the more important thing, is if we analyze from Arsenal's perspective, I think it was a great, well, not great, but it was a good game.
Yeah, it's a strong 3 points, right? This a 3-0 victory on the road against a team that has been one of the better defensive teams in the league. I think you have to take that.
Exactly. What I'd also say is when looking at the fact that, you know, Watford haven't been fantastic recently, you're probably saying, okay, 3-0. Just take it, like you say. Mm-hmm. But what else? What are you supposed to add to that? And what you would add to that, therefore, there's still more to be improved on at Arsenal in terms of how efficient they are.
Yeah, it wasn't one of Watford's best performances. I thought in this one they were carried more by individuals than we have seen to this point this year. Specifically, I thought Etienne Capoue was very influential in the middle of the park, and Troy Deeney's work in the first half was just marveled on by the announcers, and rightly so. Kartik, I want to ask you about your impressions about Arsenal, because you're somebody that I think has been shown throughout our podcast to be very tuned into Arsenal, very observant, and at this point very aware of kind of the inconsistencies, the very high peaks, the low valleys of their plays. So where would you put Saturday's performance on that kind of spectrum?
I guess somewhere in between. I didn't like what we saw in the first half, and I thought Capoue really bossed it, and actually had an Arsenal fan last night, a PR director for the Four Laurel Strikers, Stephen Bernasconi, who watches Arsenal as intently as he watches the team he works for, tell me what happened to the Capoue that we Spurs that was so inept in central midfield. I mean, he dominated our guys, and I agree with that. I thought he was the best player in the first half. Troy Deeney was very good going forward. Second half, I thought Watford were good until that first goal, and then it just kind of all came apart. But so I guess the thing we can say for Arsenal is, in games where they're not playing well, away from home against teams that are tough to break down, they were able to get a result, and a decisive-looking one at that. So that's a positive sign, but again, it was a classic Arsenal letdown game. Now, that having been said, we're coming off an international break. They just beat United 3-0, and they've got Bayern this week. So maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Champions League games at the end of the show. But speaking of 3-0 results, speaking of Manchester United, the Everton-Manchester United game is one that we highlighted in the preview podcast as a litmus test for both teams. So much uncertainty around each of them. Manchester United's inconsistent form. Everton not knowing if they really are going to challenge for the top four. And Kartik, in that sense, I think we did learn a lot about each of these teams. Manchester United, for the first 45-60 minutes, were as good as I think we've seen them this year. We can talk about why. Louis van Gaal made a number of significant changes. And then Everton just, I don't know if they just didn't look prepared, or maybe Louis van Gaal, the changes that he made kind of left Roberto Martinez's team confused, but they certainly didn't seem to have even a toehold in the game until 20-25 minutes in, when they were already down 2-0.
Yeah, and I couldn't get it, because I thought there was big news in the morning. Howard Kendall, who is actually one of my favorite managers, came to Manchester City for a year. One of the many links between Everton and Manchester City, brought Peter Reid with him from Everton, and Peter Reid helped build a good Manchester City club after Howard Kendall decided to go back to Everton a year later, had passed away. And I thought that would give everybody a Goodison lift. It would give everybody associated with Everton and Manchester City, those two clubs who both had pre-match ceremonies, a lift. In fact, it seemed to do the opposite to Everton. They were deflated. They looked out of sorts. They looked tactically naive. And I thought they were just awful. And this is another example of to me, of Martinez getting it really wrong in a big game like this. One quick thing I would state is that Anthony Martial, I thought, was fantastic in this match. He won Player of the Month, something I think was not deserved this past month on the Premier League. I think that that should have gone to Jamie Vardy, hands down. He certainly proved himself in this game in a big atmosphere away from home. In a game where United historically have had a lot of trouble. Fergie never used to beat Moyes in those games, which is part of the reason Moyes got the United job.
It was three seasons in a row there where they didn't do very well. There was a long time where United hadn't done very well. Yeah. And then even more, I think I actually spoke to a United fan today and he said the atmosphere at Goodison seemed similar to the time when at Old Trafford they were remembering the Busby Babes.
That was a game against Man City. I remember that well. And that was pre-takeover Manchester City. And we went into Old Trafford and beat them badly.
Yes.
Because it was a subdued, kind of somber day. Johnny got a goal right off the bat and it was done.
And he said he remembered it felt a very similar vibe to that. And it was one of the very few times I've actually thought a Manchester United fan looked sympathetic. But It was an interesting thing to hear that he would go as far as to say that, because it was I think, you know, it looked, essentially you were right in what you were saying, is that it looked as if Everton let themselves down. And that's one thing I definitely put across Merseyside right now, is that there's worries about the tactical adaptability of their managers, maybe.
Yeah, it seemed like that as much as we were concerned that Van Gaal had gotten it wrong at the Emirates, it seemed like he very much got it right in this one. He moved Rooney up to the striker position, pushed Martial out wide. He moved Ander Herrera into the starting lineup. He was very influential, his energy in the middle of the park, above Schneiderlin and Schweinsteiger in deeper midfield roles. Juan Mata pinching in very narrowly. A lot of times they were outnumbering Everton 4-5-2 in midfield, as Ross Barkley, still very young, seemed to not be able to adapt and find a way to influence the game. Lawrence, we kind of alluded to Manchester United's play when we were talking about Manchester City, the dominance they had over the whole game. You know, throughout the first 30, maybe even 45 minutes of this one, I looked at this Manchester United team and said, whew, this now looks like a team that could challenge for a title. Maybe I was overreacting to that small window, but for me, this was as impressive as we've seen Manchester United this year.
Yeah, I think in relative terms, it certainly was. I think they got the midfield shape right, like you say. But I also feel like they were allowed that midfield dominance.
Yeah. There's only so much Barry McCarthy can do when they're just so outnumbered.
Well, exactly. And I one thing I am interested in from both of you guys is the best positions to play the likes of Barkley, and also then the best positions to play the likes of Rooney as well. Because there was an interesting conversation this week on ITV, which is a rare thing to say in England. But they said, where does Barkley play best? You know, is he a Totti number 10? Is he a Baggio number 10? Is he a Wayne Rooney number 10?
Yeah, I actually have no idea. You know, there was the middle of this week, Roberto Martinez making the case to the public that Barkley needs to be a all-time starter. But Kartik, to me, this match showed that Barkley, even though he was more influential in the second half, can still be taken advantage of, and that he didn't have an influence in the game. He didn't make himself a factor in that first half. And so when you see games like this, you wonder what Ross Barkley can do when he's without the ball. And even when he's with the ball, I think that he's still more of a player of moments and not a player to set tempo. And that's why I wonder if we're still like 2 or 3 years away from Ross Barkley being a player you can truly build a team around.
Yeah, our mutual friend, Richard, Neil Blackman, who follows Everton very closely, he likes Barkley in this sort of withdrawn role in the hole behind the lone striker, which in this case would be Lukaku, and a guy who can pop up in different areas, attacking areas. But to me, again, that's a guy, just as you outlined, that doesn't set tempo, doesn't set pace, but is a man of moments. And he has some spectacular moments, but he's not Wayne Rooney. I mean, the comparisons have been obvious to Rooney because of the Everton connection, the Scouser connection. But he's not that kind of player. He's not going to dictate tempo or pace or necessarily run at guys from that kind of number 10 position. So he's a guy who needs good service, who needs to make the right runs and find the right spaces, or at times just pick up rebounds. Or if a winger cuts inside, we know Everton has a glut of wingers. It was Aaron Lennon who started in this game, which somewhat surprised me. But when that winger cuts inside, Barkley can make a run off of the winger and get himself into space and take a shot on goal. Those are the sorts of things he does well. But as far as being a guy who dictates the pace and tempo of a match, he's not there. And this leaves the guys like McCarthy and Besic when he's fit, Naismith. Gareth Barry, Naismith. Yeah. It leaves them doing a whole lot more than they might otherwise have to do.
Yeah, and it leaves them as that team that is so much better on the counter and not as a team that can go against teams that will sit back and force you to break them down, because they're left with really more relying on players like Kone or these other players that we've seen step up and have moments, whereas Barkley's best moments have come on the counter. Lawrence, I cut you off. Go ahead.
Well, I keep trying to cut you off. Sorry. I think that's part of this generation of footballers is that actually they're not stuck between two generations, but the emphasis is so much on the system. And you know, the fact that they have to play into that, and I don't think that's always to the player's detriment. I think it's when they understand that, then that very often becomes one of their greatest things. Like we look at Mesut Ozil, who set the record this weekend for the most assists in Europe, I think it was, and that was ahead of another great number 10 in Raquel May. And we're looking at a really dominant number 10 there against someone who's so constantly lamented for the fact that he floats in and out of games.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot to be said for what we see from Barkley and talk about him as a player of moments. And I can sense it in your voice when you say that. That isn't necessarily what you consider to be a positive for him or a positive for the team, maybe.
Yeah.
But well, I think what we are stuck with, and I think maybe you're right to do that. I would probably feel the same way. But what we are stuck with is a generation where when things aren't quite clicking, then we don't see a very strong performance from them at all. And I think sometimes that's a real problem in the Premier League because it can lead to less entertainment and possibly a poorer match because of it. And I think a 3-0 game, whilst exciting for United fans, is probably a poorer match overall.
Yeah, there are a lot of players who are players in moments. At least they have those moments. For most players, they can only dream of the best moments that Ross Barkley has, seemingly.
But that's to the detriment to some people. Like, I mean, personally,
you mentioned Mesut Ozil, yeah. Yeah.
Well, think about Steven Gerrard in this Liverpool team now. If a young Steven Gerrard was coming through in this Liverpool team, I wonder the difference in Steven Gerrard now. That's and true. You think how many times would he trade the moments he had for the silverware that could have been if he was playing within a system which always benefited him?
Now, that's a very interesting dichotomy there. I hadn't really thought about it before. Let's go ahead and take our first trip to Europe and talk about the weekend's biggest game, which, as tradition dictates, kicked off as we started recording. Inter and Juventus were waging the season's first Derby d'Italia as we speak. But you don't have to wait for us to finish talking. You're probably listening to us at the point where highlights are available. Go and check that out. It was 0-0 in the middle of the first half as we hit record. Elsewhere in Italy, though, Fiorentina was handed its second loss of the year with a 2-1 defeat at Napoli, a result that allowed Roma to move within a point of the top after their 3-1 win at Empoli on Saturday. Of course, what I just said becomes irrelevant. If Inter wins, they go to the top of the table, pushing the Giallorossi down a little bit more. But let's move to a league where we do know the results, Germany, where Bayern Munich got an early goal from Thomas Müller at Werder Bremen and held out for a 1-0 win. Bayern is now perfect through 9 rounds, a record for them. They've scored 29 times, they've only allowed 4 goals, and they have a 7-point lead on Borussia Dortmund, who got back into the win column with a 2-0 victory on Friday at Mainz, something of a welcome back Jurgen Klopp derby there. The only other thing I wanted to talk about in Germany is Borussia Mönchengladbach, who saw Lucien Favre resign a month ago, and since then they haven't lost a game in league. They scored 5 times at Frankfurt on Saturday, a 5-1 win, and are now in 10th place after their 4th win in a row. They were at the bottom of the table when Favre left. It's not good news for Juventus. Juventus is starting their Champions League back-to-back with Die Frohlen this week. But as far as elsewhere this weekend, gentlemen, there were a number of standout performers in the Premier League. Alas, we're only allowed to pick one for our player of the week. But Lawrence, that doesn't mean that you can't go ahead and mention every player that you thought deserved a little bit of consideration. Who stood out to you this weekend?
It's like that, is it?
It is like that, yes.
My honorable mentions yet again. The nuance of my play is taken away because you want me to be a man of moments. Sterling is going to be my player of the week here, Richard.
Okay.
Because part of me wonders, good God, wouldn't it be great to have Sterling in this Liverpool team with Jurgen Klopp?
38-minute mark. I thought 32 around is when you would say that, because that's definitely what I was thinking this weekend too. Jeez, what Jurgen Klopp would do with Raheem Sterling.
Yeah, and what Raheem Sterling would do with Jurgen Klopp. So that's why he's that. You know, a hat trick. I think a lot of people have been speaking about his finishing for a while, but I mean, Kartik, you remember the great goal which convinced me of his finishing, which was the moment when he took it to the back line of City. He swerves one way for Liverpool, swerves the other way, and there's almost like a 4 or 5 foot gap that he can slot the ball into. And that's when I knew he was a good finisher. And you think the kid can hold his head. It's just about what he has around him and how he becomes focused by a manager, you know? And I think that,
yeah,
that's it.
In fact, I think I've said it before on the show that part of the reason Pellegrini was so set on signing him, and he was the one guy Pellegrini really wanted. The other targets that were signed by City this summer were largely boardroom targets, the De Bruyne's, the Delphs, etc., was because he had that kind of success against City. It's not just that goal. Every time Liverpool played Manchester City, he was the standout player for Liverpool, even more so than Suarez or Sturridge when Sturridge was fit.
Yeah, no, good point. Although my other mentions are obviously Chan, Origi, Kane, and Berahino. Mm-hmm. Berahino, just because I love how people have so quickly forgotten all the farcical stuff that happened not long ago. Oh, he's good. Oh, yeah, great. Okay, bye-bye.
Not even mentioning it at all anymore. No, you're right on Sterling. Two of the goals he had this weekend were just really great instinctual goals. One, he was just cleaning up in front of goal, but two of them, he really crafted those chances for himself amid a very willing defense trying to stop him. Kartik, your player of the week.
I'm going to go with Riyad Mahrez, who is just this out-of-sight, incredible player, particularly when Leicester is behind in games. A player who was with them in the championship has become, I think, one of the top African players, obviously featuring for Algeria. Mm. And he is just a terror to handle defensively. You can't mark him one-on-one. He has these sorts of trick moves that a lot of wingers have when he cuts inside, but his final product is so much better than your average winger, or not even your average winger, than your other outstanding wingers in the English league. I mean, I defended Jesus Navas earlier, but Navas's end product is what City fans, I guess, ultimately get unhappy about. Mahrez has this ability to bring other players into the game. He has this special connection going with Vardy, and Leicester just have something going on that is tough to quantify, right?
Yes,
give Claudio Ranieri all kinds of credit for their results, but they've got something else about them, and they're continuing to get results and sneak results out because I think of Mahrez and Jamie Vardy.
Yeah, I don't think anybody has it quite figured out. It's interesting. Riyad Mahrez has turned into kind of a super sub. He's now coming off the bench, and he's still having these great performances. If you want to know a reason why Leicester keeps coming back in games, it's because they're a completely different team when they bring him on. My player of the week was going to be Jamie Vardy after watching that game, mostly for, in addition to the two goals he scored in the second half, just the number of chances his effort creates, and you compare it to other players around the league, it's incredible, and you understand why he's one of the league's best scorers right now. But I ended up changing it because after watching Everton-Manchester United, I came away from that game just very envious of the potential center-back pairing that Roy Hodgson has with John Stones and Chris Smalling. And in this game, Chris Smalling really stood out. He was playing with Phil Jones for the first time this year, at least it was Phil Jones' first start. So Smalling actually moved over to the left, which has been Daley Blind's spot. And he was his typical, I don't want to say typical, because it's not like Chris Smalling has been so dominant for so long that we can say it's typical, but he was always the person making the last play, to the point you're watching the game and you're saying, Everton's not going to score. Chris Smalling is always there. I thought it was just a really good performance. And on a weekend where there were a lot of goals, there are always a lot of goals in the Premier League, and not a lot of central defenders stood out, I gave the nod to Chris Smalling on this one. Gentlemen, let's move on a little bit here. Let's talk about the second big managerial debut of the weekend. I think there was a lot of optimism around Sam Allardyce's debut with Sunderland. They certainly came out and played well at the beginning at the Hawthorns, but a second half goal means that Sam Allardyce is the latest Sunderland manager to lose his debut ahead of a Tyne-Wear derby. Kartik, you are a big, I don't want to say a big Sam apologist. You're not an apologist at all. You're apt to point out that this person is somebody that does get results and probably gets derided a little bit too much. It was definitely a mixed bag this weekend, and I think that he's going to be a little remiss for not getting a point out of his debut.
What do you mean? Yeah, sorry, what? That's ridiculous, Richard. He didn't do anything this weekend.
Well, it was a difficult place to start, right? Playing against West Brom, but at the Hawthorns in a venue where Tony Pulis is good at locking down the game. But I thought there were some bizarre calls, and quite frankly, I was surprised by Big Sam going with Borini and going with Danny Graham at points in this game, and really putting a lot on those two guys who have not produced at all in the Premier League in quite some time. Borini last produced when he got Sunderland out of trouble under Gus Poyet when he was on loan from Liverpool two seasons ago. Danny Graham hasn't produced since he was at Swansea. He's another one of those players who, once he left Swansea, his form dropped off. So there's a long list of those players. So I was surprised by that. Positive for American fans, DeAndre Yedlin played 90 minutes and looked very good. Looked the part, didn't look out of place at all, like most American players do when they make a Premier League debut, or this is the second game for Yedlin as a starter, but he looked quite good. So the Tyne Wear derby has been, and I'm sure we'll talk about it more, obviously, next week, but it has been this trap game for Newcastle, where Sunderland's managers win over their supporters. I don't think Big Sam's going to have quite the problems of the previous managers, because he is Big Sam. He's English. He played for that club. He knows that club. He come to that club at one point before with Peter Reid. So I think it's a little bit different. But Di Canio, he won over the supporters by beating Newcastle. Poyet won over the supporters by beating Newcastle over and over again. And then Advocaat beat Newcastle to get out of trouble last season. So it's almost an automatic now that Sunderland beats Newcastle. Sunderland's in trouble. Sunderland's looking for a result. They get Newcastle. They beat them. So that's probably what will happen next week.
Lawrence, aside from the kind fixture ahead for Sunderland, did you see anything else from this weekend's performance that should give Black Cat supporters reason for hope?
Honestly, I think the thing that gives them most hope is the way that they played their last game under Advocaat. And the fact that the players changed so quickly. I'm really interested in Sam Allardyce's lexicon. One minute he says, what he'll do is he'll say, they didn't create anything. And then he'll say, but we defended well. And suddenly you see a lot of the way that Sam Allardyce conducts himself out on out in the press. Don't know if it's indicative of the man, but I think it definitely says something about the way that he considers himself at Sunderland, the way he considers his role at Sunderland. I think the positives that can probably be taken away for them is that they do have options. They have, I mean, bringing on Jermaine Defoe when things aren't working is maybe not the best way to go, but it is a way to go. You'd say the same with Graham and the same with Johnson. But like I say, the last game that I saw with Advocaat and the way that the players played is probably the biggest boost for them because of the fact that they were just so much better and unfortunate actually to lose that game.
You alluded to that last game under Advocaat, two goal lead early against West Ham, then a red card, two goals come back for West Ham, ended up splitting points there. West Ham, another game this weekend, two late goals, this time at Selhurst Park. Lawrence, just a game that was ruined by an early, I don't want to say unfortunate red card, because Dwight Gale's red card was deserved, but certainly an absent-minded red card, and one that capped a very active 20 minutes for Dwight Gale, and ultimately probably cost his team at least one, maybe even 3 points.
Yeah, I think a lot of people would agree with you. I spoke to someone who was there for the match, and they said up until that point, it actually felt like a very even game.
It was a very exciting game, I thought, until that point.
And I think, what's probably right to say for both sets of fans is that actually they're both very good judges of good footballers. And I think both of them are very complimentary about the other side. So a lot of West Ham fans saying how much they enjoyed Yannick Bolasie, Zaha and the effort from Gale until that point. And then the point would be made the opposite way with how much people enjoyed Lanzini and Payet. And I think what's interesting is we spoke about it on a previous podcast, but maybe just Gale wasn't the striker that they wanted in this game up front for Crystal Palace. And for that reason, things had to change. But they really do lack a big man up there, or someone that can battle a little bit more in a slightly different way. And that's what they lacked in this match, because genuinely, up until he got sent off, 1-1, and it could have gone either way. And, you know, I think Crystal Palace are going to be disappointed for that reason, because they want to be winning these kind of matches. And it's the kind of thing where I think especially Alan Pardew will be aware of what might creep into the players' minds, and how he will be aware of a repeat of the things that happened at Newcastle for that same reason.
Kartik, West Ham sits fourth right now, and as Lawrence reminds us, we're still too early to be looking at that table as if it means anything. But I think the reason I bring that up is that West Ham is not performing like a team that should be lower. They are performing like a team that, if they keep this up, are going to challenge for spots in Europe, maybe troublesome teams for that fourth spot, that last Champions League spot. But I get the feeling when we do our top fours here in a couple minutes, none of us are going to have West Ham in our end of the year top four. So my question to you is, what do we need to see from West Ham in order to get past this kind of early skeptical phase where we look at this as a good start to where we look at this as endemic of the team they actually are?
Well, just keep getting these sorts of results and putting in these sorts of performances. The only points they've dropped away from home the entire season was, of course, that game that you mentioned, that Lawrence mentioned against Sunderland. They won at Arsenal. They won at Anfield. They won at the Etihad. They've now won at Selhurst, which has become a very difficult place to play as well.
Yeah.
And so they're getting results. They just need to keep it going. This might be a good harbinger for next year, because some people would argue that they're going to play 38 away matches next season with where their new home venue is. So it's good that they're learning to play away from home, because they're not going to have I joke about that, but they're not going to have the sort of home turf advantage that you have now at the Bowling Ground at the Olympic Stadium. I think that's pretty obvious to just about everybody. So this is good that they're learning to get results away from home, and that will make them a better team at home next season when they don't have the natural advantage they have right now at Upton Park.
Last match before we turn back to Europe, Southampton 2, Leicester 2. Lawrence, this was definitely a tale of two halves. Leicester very poor on set pieces in the first half, saw both Southampton central defenders score, and then Southampton just seemed to take their foot off the gas around the hour mark. If there's one team in the league you don't want to do that with right now, it's Leicester. Two goals from Jamie Vardy, Riyad Mahrez coming on, helping change the game. I hate to throw this to you with kind of a, well, what did we learn from this? But is there a point at which we learn why Leicester has become this team that almost needs to fall behind in order to get into gear?
Is it to some extent the underdog mentality, with which you'd imagine that Ranieri's maybe working with the players? From that reason, though, you'd maybe say, well, you know, why aren't they then battling from the very beginning if they feel like they're always behind? I think it must be difficult to balance that, because with the wins comes a change in mentality. And you sort of think, well, how do you plan for players basically becoming more and more confident, when actually originally, you would have wondered what their league position would be. But then he says he's always planned to be up this season. So it was never about battling relegation, but it was also never about getting too high. So I wonder whether it's just about striking the right balance, and actually that it swings one way and then swings the back. And maybe that's a little bit too neat for what we're trying to describe, because actually Leicester don't look like a very neat team at times. but what I do find interesting about them is the players that are playing well under Ranieri have got some very similar qualities, but from different backgrounds. And so you see where Ranieri's good at working with certain kinds of player and certain kinds of mentalities. And I think that's all built upon look at that back line and how solid that has the potential to be. And then look at also how quickly it was undone. Mm-hmm. What you would say is that look at the statistics in this match, and Southampton were dominated in terms of possession. They only have 43% possession for a side that would expect to do better. They had less shots. They had less corners, they had less free kicks, all those kind of things. And you think they should be dominating these kind of games against a team like Leicester, but they didn't. So you've got to wonder how and why did they let them back in? And I think that's partly down to the mentality employed.
It might be a little bit to injury too. Southampton had two injuries in this game. Cedric with a very bad cut over his left eye eventually left the game. Vincent Wanyama left the game too. The defense fell apart after that, after Maya Oshida came in, after they had to bring Jordi Klaas in off the bench to augment that middle. But Kartik, Lawrence mentioned that defense for Leicester, and I agree with him. You have Robert Huth, Wes Morgan back there. You have a good goalkeeper. You've got decent people in the middle. They shouldn't be giving up as many goals as they do. But it's not only that they're giving up goals as a function of kind of a give and take in their style of play. This weekend, it was just they couldn't defend set pieces. And before, we've just seen them kind of get the basics wrong. And how worried should Fox's supporters be about that?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, we keep focusing on these comebacks, or at least I do, and Mahrez and Vardy and how good those guys are going forward, and Drinkwater when he supplements the attack, etc. But they are continuing to ship goals in kind of curious ways. They seem to be torn apart very easily early in matches. So this is really kind of a big question, because on paper it looks like it's a solid back line. I don't really have an explanation other than to say that they're not starting games well, and they're getting pulled apart, and they don't necessarily have the kind of ball winning presence in midfield, holding midfield that perhaps you would like to see from this sort of team, and they don't have the guy that keeps them organized in Cambiaso, playing in kind of a central midfield withdrawn midfield role that they had last season. So maybe those are the reasons.
A very interesting team, though, for all their flaws and all their achievements so far. Leicester continues week in, week out to be worth your money. You're worth your cable subscription money. Let's jump back to Europe for a bit, to Spain, where there were a couple of big games, neither of which involved Barcelona or Real Madrid. Both of those Titans won by 3 goals at home, and they're tied for the league lead right now. But it's a three-way tie with Celta Vigo, who handed Villarreal, the previous leaders, their second straight loss. Again, the yellow submarine had an early sending off, just as they had before the break in their first loss of the season. This time, though, they didn't pay for it until near the final whistle, when Nolito gave Celta a 2-1 win. They're even with Barca and El Real, all three teams passing Villarreal this weekend. Elsewhere, David Moyes' hot seat is going to heat up a little more after Real Sociedad lost at home today 2-0 to Atletico. La Real finished with 9 men, but played 89 minutes with 11. An early goal from Antoine Griezmann had Atleti up almost the whole game. Atletico, like Villarreal, is only 2 points off the top. Quickly, in France, PSG won again, 2-0 at Bastia. Zlatan Ibrahimovic scored both goals. He's already up to 6 after a very slow start to the season, and the Parisians are 5 points clear at the top of Ligue 1. The league's biggest game, however, happened on Friday when Lyon went to Monaco for what I'm sure was a well-attended game on Friday night at the Stade Louis II. former Manchester United fullback Rafael da Silva scored in the 84th minute to give Lyon a 1-1 draw there. Gentlemen, let's go back to the Premier League. It's time for our top fours, and I'll go ahead and short straw it this week and go first. On form, you know, we are getting to the point where for me the form kind of matches the end of the year a little bit. I have City, Arsenal, United, and West Ham as my four on form. And as far as end of the year, no changes for me right now. I still see City, United, Arsenal. I kind of flip-flop those in my mind. I'm really close to believing in this Arsenal team, though, and putting them number two. And then I have Spurs. But I still see City as being the team that's going to claim this title. For the reasons we said earlier in the show, no team is matching City's heights. And when they're healthy, if they ever do get fully healthy, I just don't see them stumbling. Kartik.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat as you. First time this season where the top four that I have are the same top four I have at the end of the season, not in the same order at all, actually, but same club. So my on form, I've got Spurs 1. They still haven't lost since the opening day of the season. Arsenal 2, City 3, United 4. End of the season, City 1, Arsenal 2, United 3, Spurs 4.
Lawrence.
Yeah, I'm going to match you both you guys up, but what I'm going to say is end of the year, I think, is either Spurs or Liverpool in fourth spot.
Yeah, that's me too. As much as I want to talk up West Ham or even Crystal Palace, I still think of Spurs and Liverpool, and I get the feeling within 2 or 3 weeks, Klopp is going to have me convinced to shake up that top four. Gentlemen, there's one big team we haven't mentioned yet in the show. It doesn't actually feel wrong. It kind of feels like this is where Chelsea should be right now. And yeah. I don't want to diminish what was a big win for them. I mean, at this point, any win is big, and they're back from the bottom of the table to mid-table. But Lawrence, 2-0 victory over Aston Villa, number of changes Jose Mourinho made. But when I was watching that game, yeah.
This is boring, isn't it?
When I was watching that game, I just kind of felt like this is pretty much what we should expect. No big deal.
Yeah. So this was a great podcast, guys. I think if we do the same next week, should we just convene about 8 o'clock?
Sure.
What's your problem? I don't think there's much more to add, right, Richard?
No, they didn't. They didn't play well. No. Chelsea did not play well in this game. Villa, I thought, were the better team. Brad Guzan, absolute howler. or if you can call a bad clearance or
his,
a bad
his monthly mistake.
Yeah, his monthly mistake, and then Costa, nice goal, but the second half I thought Villa were the better team.
Yeah.
I was actually kind of stunned how poorly Chelsea came out. I thought, okay, Mourinho says he has all the players behind him. Maybe I was wrong. We're going to see a response, and they looked flat at the Bridge, and Villa, the team that is probably the worst team in the league at this point, looked, I thought, much better than they did for the 90 minutes. So I'm unconvinced completely by this, and I think Mourinho is just running out the clock now on his own tenure.
There are sort of unusual things that go with this one. I've been reading the possession stats quite a lot this week. I don't know why. I just found them interesting. Villa had more possession than Chelsea.
Ooh.
And more
shots. I didn't even realize that. Ooh.
Yeah.
That I knew.
Yeah. And that's one of the interesting sides. But then, I mean, it is also that then there have to be things that I think you should applaud. Aspilicueta's finally in the right berth for the side,
mm-hmm.
although that's probably enforced because of injury. Another thing. Zuma is obviously starting there, which I quite like. Baba Rahman, obviously. And then Loftus-Cheek in midfield as well, even though Loftus-Cheek only played the 45 and Nemanja Matic came on and also had a reasonably comfortable performance. What you would say is the reason that this performance changed for Chelsea was down to the introduction of Hazard. So, everything that I think it looked as if Mourinho was setting out to prove, he then almost disproved. So, but then again, there's the great meta that everyone says where it's like, well, is he then making the point, I can't do it with these players, to whoever he's trying to make the point to? And at that point, you kind of say, well,
what players does he want? I mean, what players is he expecting? Does he think he's getting Thomas Müller or getting Lewandowski or Ronaldo? I mean, this is ridiculous. And look at their squad.
But that's part of it, Kartik, I think, is that actually Mourinho is very good at making temporary things feel very permanent. And the point is that form would be temporary, but the class of most of these players would remain permanent. Hence why when De Bruyne goes away from the club, then his class shines through. When other players have gone away, they probably play better because the temporality of what Mourinho says of his players sticks around. And I think a lot of people speak about that in the moment in London is the there's almost like a haze around the club but it's a haze of negativity. And right. that sticks around and sticks with the players. And at times that is really detrimental to the club. But it feels, when you're in that, it feels so permanent. We've all worked in a workplace like that, where it feels so sort of negative, and that negativity feels permanent until someone comes along and sort of goes, oh, we should probably change this.
One of the great things about Jurgen Klopp coming to the Premier League and taking the high-profile Liverpool job, which we know a lot of the media support Liverpool anyway, is that I think they're going to pay less attention to this clown at Chelsea, and he's not going to get the kind of enablement he's gotten in the past because there's another really high-profile, colorful, interesting and exciting manager in the league, and they don't have to suck up to this guy constantly. So that's very good news, I think, for all of us.
And as Jose Mourinho takes himself a little bit out of the sack race, Tim Sherwood seems to be the person that everybody's focusing on now, especially with Brendan Rodgers now available and already links between him and Aston Villa. Newcastle 6-2 was the last result of the weekend that we haven't talked about. Jorginho Wijnaldum, 4 goals there. Kartik, really, it felt like a must win for Steve McClaren, not in the sense that he was going to be sacked at the end of it, but there would be no reason not to talk about him as if he wouldn't be sacked. So in that way, very positive result. In the same time, this was the worst we've seen Norwich play all year.
Yeah, I mean, Norwich has been so solid and so strong this season. And since Alex Neil took over last season in the championship, remember, they were struggling the first half of the championship season. They were the best team in the championship the second half of the year and had started this Premier League season so brightly. So I guess this was the type of result, given that Newcastle needed the game, you probably should have expected. 6-2 is emphatic, but Norwich created chances, but defensively they were very poor. They should have gotten a third or fourth goal, hit the post a couple times. Nathan Redmond continues to be one of the better and most underappreciated English players in the Premier League for Norwich. But I thought Newcastle were very good. And again, I thought they were pretty good for about 40 minutes against Man City. I thought they were good against Chelsea and got very unlucky and should have won that game. So I think McLaren is getting the buy-in from the players. I mean, they brought in a lot of players. They've got some very expensive and high-profile players, most of whom produced today. And as long as they can keep Sissoko pleased and kind of hungry, although I was concerned about his defensive work rate today, quite honestly, but he was very good going forward. They'll get out of this because they have enough talent, and there are other teams that are worse. That having been said, they play Sunderland next week, and as I said, the Tyne Wear Derby the last few years has been where the new Sunderland manager has always made their mark, beating the local rivals, so I expect Sunderland to win just because that's the way it's been going. That's not an indictment of Newcastle.
Monday's game, closing the weekend of the Premier League, Swansea is hosting Stoke. A lot of people are already looking forward to the Champions League games this week. On Tuesday, Bayern Munich versus Arsenal. Chelsea is at Dynamo Kiev. Kind of a trap game there for Chelsea. If they're not on their game, that's definitely losable considering the form that we've seen from them this year. But obviously, most people are going to be focusing on Arsenal versus Bayern Munich. Lawrence, I look at this game, and I think this is a great example of how we sometimes exaggerate the differences between teams, because Arsenal is going to be looked at as this huge underdog in this game, which perhaps when you look at the numbers is true. We've seen Arsenal over 60, 90 minute spans over the last few years compete with the Barcelonas and Bayern Munichs of the world. And if we were to have these two teams in one league together, if Arsenal were in the Bundesliga, we would say, well, this is a tough game for Bayern because Arsenal is a Champions League caliber team and you never know what can happen in one game. And I think that logic still holds. You never know what can happen in one game. But when we see these two teams match up against each other so infrequently, there's this tendency to exaggerate the difference in quality between the two.
Absolutely. I agree with the theory, but then you think an application, that exaggeration maybe plays into certain things, and the differences maybe highlight some of the reasons why the difference between the two. So that counter environment is going to mean that Arsenal are portrayed as the inferior club. Maybe it means they play up to it. Maybe it means they play down to it.
you never know with Arsenal. That's as we always say on the show.
Well, I guess that's part of the frustration with them, isn't it? Is that actually, if there's one thing we can take from the week of Jurgen Klopp focus, it's that I want to turn Liverpool from doubters to believers, and how much of a difference that made to the club in 1 week. And if you were, and I said this to an Arsenal fan earlier, imagine if Jurgen Klopp had just taken over at Arsenal, what would we be thinking and saying now?
A couple of us might have Arsenal number one on our at the end of the season list.
I think we would, yeah. But so yeah, no, so then this is that, and think of that tiny difference. But yeah. Then I guess that the disrespect that comes from that would be that we're not applying the good things. It's like, exactly like I was saying. If we'd have had Brendan Rodgers go out to the pitch, it would have been Brendan looked out. What a disparaging look on his face he had towards the Anfield turf. When Klopp goes out, it's he surveyed every blade of grass lovingly, and you sort of think, you know, there's a huge difference between the two, but actually the two managers are of the same caliber and doing, you know, obviously they're looking to achieve different things in different ways, but it's very much about the perception from the outside. And I think sometimes that gets in the way of the analysis. And like you say, the analysis here would be the two are very close, but there are small factors which would mean that Bayern Munich have probably got the upper hand here. And it's those small factors, I think, that and the attention to detail that has taken Guardiola and this Bayern Munich side the step further.
On Wednesday, Manchester United is going to be in Moscow to take on CSKA. Manchester City is hosting Sevilla. With all of these games this week, they're the first of two match sets. The reverse are going to happen in a couple of weeks in Champions League. But Kartik, the big game is happening on Tuesday, so I want to go back to it. Arsenal, Bayern, we're all very familiar with these teams at this point. What are you expecting out of the game on Tuesday at the Emirates?
Oh, I think Arsenal has a great chance the way they're playing. Of course, we talked about the letdown in this last game, but I think they've got a real opportunity to win this game. Bayern has not lost yet this season. They've been bailed out in a couple games. They've gotten fortunate, but they've been playing at a very, very high level, obviously. So I think ultimately where I sit, I think there is a real possibility that they can be caught. They've got a game coming where they're not going to fire on all cylinders. And I think Arsenal, because of the way their Champions League campaign has started and the doubts, look, their league form has been very good, but I think we're extrapolating their poor performances in Champions League. And I know about this because I've tended to see this happen with Manchester City for years, where the poor performances in Champions League were then used by media and analysts to say, well, they're really not that strong in the league. But it really wouldn't affect Manchester City's league form. There would never be this kind of bleed-on effect. And Arsenal has clearly shown they don't have the bleed-on effect. Lost to Olympiacos, turned around and crushed Manchester United. I think that there's been this narrative about their league campaign partly influenced by what's happened in Champions League. If they get a result in this game, even if it's a draw, I think it changes all of the thinking about Arsenal, this fatalistic thinking. And there's a lot of fatalism always among Arsenal supporters and among the media when it comes to covering Arsenal. So I think they have a good shot in this matchup. Lewandowski's not going to he cooled off this weekend coming off of his great performances with Poland. And I think maybe Arsenal will figure him out.
As you mentioned, this is a back-against-the-wall game for Arsenal, having taken 0 points in two of their easier games in this group. Now they have their two most difficult games coming up over the next fortnight or a couple of weeks. That's what a fortnight is, Richard. They have to really get 3 points. They really have to get 3 points in this one. Even a draw would probably see their chances of advancing go out the window. We're going to be back next week. We'll probably talk a little bit about what happened in Champions League, but mostly we're going to be focusing on the 10th match day of the Premier League season. But until then, for Lawrence McKenna, I'm Richard Farley. Kartik?
Enjoy your footballs.
The World Soccer Talk podcast is produced by Christopher Harris and Richard Farley and is a production of worldsoccertalk.com. For more information on the show, check us out at worldsoccertalk.com or subscribe through our iTunes feed. You can follow World Soccer Talk on Twitter at World Soccer Talk or follow the show's hosts. Lawrence McKenna is at Lawscast. Kartik Krishnar is at KKFLA737. And I'm at Richard Farley.